Thank you, Chairperson. Bulelo Tindo, member of this committee, Minerals and Energy. Thank you.
I'll come back here before I go there across there. I've got people this side. Right, and then I'll go at the back there and then come down and write down.
Michael Hamlin, Hynek Bridge.
I think we can't hear you. Actually, it's very important that you press the microphone because recorded. I think you didn't get recorded to UPM either.
My name is Ombia Pani from the Department of Minerals and Energy.
Rod Crompton, Mercer.
Patrick McLaughlin, American Chamber, British Chamber, and Jeff Petroleum and Sabinet Law.
That's wrong, Jeff. Okay, without wasting time, I think we know each other, but you can see that three-quarter of the house is media. So, they have taken interest in this sitting. Oh, I think I also saw NUM there. I think you must introduce yourself. We just came now. Yes.
Fred Gona from NUM.
A.B. Marman, National Union of Mine Workers.
Thank you very much for the introduction. I think we know one another now. We can start interacting without wasting time. This session is more of the information about what we have been seeing in the media, and I hope that media will represent events as they are presented here today, that they've taken another interest. They are not going to go out and over-exaggerate what has been said here. And I'll allow, therefore, the department to give us a brief about the status of the electricity situation in our country, and then I'll allow members to interact with them when they have made their presentation.
Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Chair, I must firstly start by apologizing on behalf of my principals and the Department of Minerals and Energy. Unfortunately, they could not be here today. And secondly, Chair, with the challenges relating to the technology, if I can appeal to the honorable members to please follow on the handouts that have been presented, it would have been much more convenient to flash it on the overhead projector, but I believe that they might come very shortly and then we might have to interrupt the proceedings to accommodate everybody else.
That they are going. A micro, I mean a PC which is compatible with the system.
Yes, well, the projector does not
understand this one.
It does not work, but it doesn't understand my computer either. But I've got a flashlight, so it's not.
Oh, we are going to
leave. Yeah.
Okay. But okay. But you can present something as it is.
Yeah, if you can follow from.
Oh, from the slide. Okay. All right.
It's going to be a bit difficult, but we'll try. Chair, the topic of discussion today is the National Electricity Shortage Response Plan. I will not dwell on the past. We all know that we have a problem currently relating to the shortage of electricity. What I'm going to be presenting today is a response to the particular shortage of electricity. Firstly, to kick off with some statistics, some facts and figures. About the demand and supply of electricity, Chair, is that relative to 2006, demand has grown by about 1,706 megawatts, which is a 4.9% increase in demand growth. Now, this peak happens around week 25 to week 31 of the year, which is like in the middle of the winter, or rather not at the middle, but at the beginning of winter. It's about the second week of May, Chair. Now, this demand increase is happens in the context of declining reserve margins. And I think maybe I need to explain what reserve margin is. Reserve margin is the difference between
I would have loved that to sit beside the DG of Public Enterprises here now. I would have liked you to sit beside. We just introduce ourselves. If you can introduce your delegation quickly before he continues. You were just at the beginning, fortunately.
Apologies, Chair. Unfortunately, for the Director General of Public Enterprises, and I'm with Mr. Brian Dalmas, who's the Chief Operating Officer of Eskom and is acting as CEO. We were just from Scopa, so apologies for him late for this meeting.
I'm sure then it's good because they are also going to be of help. You rescue many.
I was just saying that the increase in peak demand is happening in the context of a declining reserve margin. Just to give you some perspective, is that in 1996, the reserve margin was sitting at about 25%, and it has since declined to less than 10% in 2007. And I was also trying to explain what reserve margin is, in layman terms, it is just the insurance. In other words, it is a margin that we keep just in case one of the plants breaks down, and it is defined as the difference between the peak demand and the operating capacity at that time. And I was just saying that the reserve margin is running at less than 10% at this point. If I carry on, Chair, with the statistics, is that just in terms of our 7-year forecast on what's going to happen to the reserve margin, the projection is that with the reserve margin sitting, excluding and imported, about 5.9% now, we project that it would decline to a minimum of about 2% by around 2012. And Chair, when I get the opportunity, I will show you the detail on the overhead projector. I must emphasize that it does not take into account any demand-side intervention or any interruptible loads. In other words, this is a picture which indicates that everything being equal, if we leave things as they are, the reserve margin on our insurance is likely to decline to about 2% by around 2012. Now, what has happened since January 2008? And I want to reflect very briefly on some of the facts relating to that. Is that if we start on Monday, the 14th of January 2008, we had a shortage of about 2,000 megawatts. In other words, the difference between what the system could provide and what the demand was at that time, taking into account that as we go into the winter, there is a lot of plant that goes out for maintenance, for planned maintenance, that is. Right. Now, the South African system is such that the opportunity is taken just before the winter to fix most of the plants so that they are ready, you know, for operation and optimal, you know, production in the winter months. And this is when you become most vulnerable. Now, on the 14th of January, in that context, there was a shortage of about 2,000 megawatts. Suffice it to say that ultimately the shortage peaked to about 3,000 megawatts. And that is why load shedding became inevitable. Now, what are those key drivers? I mentioned the fact that some of the plant was out on planned maintenance, but other plant was out on unplanned maintenance. In other words, the plant failed. And just to reflect on some of those failures, in other words, what caused those, what are the drivers of those unplanned outages? We have had the coal quality challenge that we face. Chair, and I think one needs to elaborate on this, is that as we're driving the plant harder and harder, Chair, maybe I should also indicate that as I say us, it's like this is a joint government and ESCOM position. What I'm presenting to you today is a position that has been jointly arrived with all the stakeholders in that sector. And I will use us to include ESCOM. But I believe ESCOM is here now and they can elaborate some more on that. But yes, the point is that as we drive this one harder and harder, in other words, as the demand increases, you're finding that the plant has to provide more energy, and therefore it consumes more and more coal. Now, the quality of the coal that is used in power generation in South Africa is famously poor quality coal. Right? Now, that situation is exacerbated when it rains differently. In other words, when the coal stockpiles get wet, it's a function of the amount of mud, if you like, or the powdery part of the coal in the stockpile. And as such, if it goes into the system, it leads to a breakdown of the plant because the coal causes boiler trips and so on in terms of the technical detail. But I think it's an important point that you need to explain because people have been asking questions that it hasn't, you know, it's not like it's the first time that it rains in South Africa and so on. But needless to say, there is an issue about coal quality causing plant failure. Then the issue of the coal quantity itself, as I indicated, if you run the plant more, you need more coal. And historically, the coal mine or the power station is predicated on the basis of the supply of coal, a dedicated mine typically. Now, if it's running harder, you need to get more coal. And therefore, you have to get additional coal from somewhere. In some instances, it is trucked in or railed in and so forth, depending on the circumstances relating to that mine. But there's also a problem in South Africa relating to the opportunity cost related to the high export coal, high export price of this poor quality coal, that more and more miners prefer to export the coal and pay the associated, rather than provide the Eskom, they would rather pay the associated penalty to Eskom. So now, we're sitting today on the 5th of March, and I guess at this point one needs to then go back and say, from the time that the load shedding has happened to now, what has been achieved? One of the objectives, Chair, in the short term, is to restore the system to a workable reserve margin. In other words, to mitigate the risk of the reserve margin falling to dangerous levels, because an example here is the fact that if the system is lost, and when we say a system is lost, we mean if a total blackout occurs in this country, estimates are that it will take about a month to restore it. You might recall that about 2-3 years ago, there was a blackout in New York, and there was no power for about 2 weeks. The advantage with New York is that it is connected with the Canadian system, so it becomes easier for them to restart their system. In the South African context, we do not have that luxury of interconnectivity, and as such, it would take longer. And you can imagine what the economic consequences of that are. So it is quite important for Eskom to do their best to safeguard that situation happening. Now, that is why the importance of a workable reserve margin becomes critical. So over the past few weeks, there has been the objective. I'm not going into some more detail there. I mentioned the issue of supply chain problems relating to the supply of coal. And share one of the ways in which you can mitigate that risk is to increase your coal stockpile. Now that has been happening over the past few weeks. And then I think coupled to that is the fact that as we prepare to go into the winter, it's important that we make sure that the plant that goes into the winter has been properly prepared by way of maintenance. Otherwise all that happens is that, you know, the winter situation becomes even more bleaker than what we have. Okay, I will skip this next slide and I'll take the cue from my IT expert here, because it is something that can only be explained on the overhead projector. But it is an illustration of how the gap between supply and demand is being mitigated. And essentially, there are two approaches to making sure that the system balances. In other words, that as the demand occurs, we are able to meet it with supply-side options. In the short term, one of the first things that could happen to mitigate is to mitigate the demand growth. In other words, demand-side management measures. Now, demand-side management is about influencing the demand for electricity by consumers to make sure that, for example, we do not waste electricity, we curb the wastage of electricity through mechanisms. Some of these mechanisms, for example, could be pricing signals, where the cost of electricity the price of electricity or the tariff must reflect the cost of generating it, so that consumers understand that when they leave the light in the room that is unoccupied, it costs money to hit them in the pocket. Now, the demand side measures that are currently underway, Chair, extensive, and I will elaborate on that later on. But I think at the same time as you try to mitigate the supply or the supply side, there are also other measures that have to happen on or on the demand. Let me start here, sorry. Whilst there are short-term interventions to mitigate an increase in demand, there also needs to be some measures on the supply side. Unfortunately, supply side options tend to be a lot more long-term because they involve, for example, making sure that we have more power stations, making sure that we generate electricity from waste heat, the so-called cogeneration, making sure that we get independent power producers, and so on. So, Chair, what I will do next is to try and focus in a little bit of more detail as to how those interventions have happened and how we see them going forward. But maybe, Chair, starting with the supply side. I think I have mentioned that the supply side will be accompanied by interventions on the intervention side, or on the demand side, but they tend to be more long-term. Chair, if I may, I'm just going to put it on the about that. So I'm just going to skip through the slides and go to this particular one just to explain that. I must also apologize because I don't have a pointer either. But Chair, what I was saying was that in terms of the interventions that need to be made in order to make sure that supply and demand balance, is that there are certain measures on the demand side which tend to be short term and they can achieve our objectives in terms of saving electricity and so on. But there are also other measures on the supply side, which means we can also increase our capacity to generate electricity. Okay, I will not go into the details. Suffice to say that in terms of those demand side interventions, intensified or accelerated demand side management is one of those programs that we have introduced. Now, you might be familiar about 2 years or 3 years ago when there was a problem with Google. There was a program to change lighting from incandescent to compact fluorescent or CFL. That is what intensified or accelerated GSM talks to. Because we believe that in the short term, a lot of energy saving can be achieved simply by changing incandescent. We estimate that, for example, of the 10 million households in this country, there is still a lot of upside in the way of thousands of megawatts, probably just under 2,000 megawatts that could be saved just by changing lighting. And that can be done in a very short term. In other words, within the year or so. Okay, and then I also mentioned that we will be doing some other things on the supply side. The return to service program, bringing back mothballed plants. You might be aware that there's still about 2,000 megawatts of power stations that are currently mothballed, and there is a plan to bring them back to working for that, so that they can also assist in generation. Okay, I will go into some detail later on in terms of that. In fact, maybe that is the next slide. Yes. Now, this is a time series, if you like, of the various supply-side options that have been put in place, starting in the year 2007, which is the yellow column, which I hope you can follow that. We're saying that a total of 1,493 megawatts will be of new megawatts will be commissioned in 2007, as indicated there, Camden, Anderlecht, open cycle, gas turbines, and so on. And if you follow to the right, Chair, you will see that a total of 21,500 megawatts is envisaged to come on stream by about 20%. Now, this is the normal scenario. In other words, this is a plan that has been in place for a long time. But clearly, Chair, you might argue that it needs to be fast-tracked in the context of the shortages that we have. And some of those fast-tracking measures involve, for example, the commissioning of an additional 1,000 megawatts of a gas-fired power plant within the year. I mentioned the issue of cogeneration. Now, this is waste heat, which South Africa currently does not take advantage of. The waste heat is processed heat from, for example, the Sasol or the furnace industries and so on, that needs to be captured so that you can then generate electricity from that. We believe that there's an upside of about 3,500 megawatts, and a process is already underway with ESCOM, with a bidding process having been started to try and capture those megawatts. The issue of maintenance is something that is receiving particular attention within ESCOM. The fact that some of the plants have come to midlife, in other words, most of the power stations are old, and as you all know, you know, failures become more, or failures increase as the plant gets older. I alluded to the issue of coal quality and supply, and there is a focus on trying to improve on that front. Now, Chair, even more significant, I believe, is the fact that an extra 3,000 megawatts of power plant is proposed to be introduced by 2012 through the use of independent power producers. In other words, the private sector contributing towards the supply side option. And so this is what the picture then looks like. In other words, if you compare to what I indicated with the normal time series, the fast track series looks like this, where the differences, for example, relate to the OCGT at the bottom in bold, and also the coal-fired baseload power station of about 2,000 megawatts.
Are those from 2007, are those all the new projects, or the you are rehabilitating other old ones? What's the position?
Chair, the Camden RTS is an old power station. RTS means return to service. So it is an existing power station that was mothballed in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And it will be brought back on stream. However, Anderlecht, Horishwa are all new power stations, Chair. But I think the difference here is that it had been part of the, if you go back to the other side, I'm going the wrong direction. If you compare to that, it's still 1,500. So the difference is that the 1,493 megawatts is planned in that particular year. And if I flip there, it's still 1,493 megawatts. I think what we're trying to show here is that in terms of the fast tracking of supply side options, we have added an OCGT gas-fired power plant over there. At the bottom, so that you could see the cursor. Yeah. That is new, Chair. And the coal-fired baseload power station is new. in order to make sure that we increase the ability to supply electricity. And then, of course, the issue of cogeneration, which I mentioned, the upside is about 3,500. The projection is that by 2009, the first 500 megawatts will come on stream, and so on. So if I move on then, and take you back to this, or rather, reflect on what we had indicated as the picture before. Remember, the reserve margin would have declined to about 2% at some point. Now we're saying that the picture could look like this in terms of, you know, all these interventions that we had talked about. And as you can see, around 2008, the reserve margin would then be sitting at about 14.2%, and then increasing all the way to 2010, you know, and maintaining a level above 10% going forward. Chair, it does not, this plan or this picture does not include the upside relating to a 10% reduction in demand, which I think maybe ESCOM and DPE can touch on. So basically what he's saying is that if we reduce demand by 10%, this picture could improve somewhat even more. It does not include imports. We import power from Mozambique. So is that...
Can you put your micro closer to you? Sometimes I'm unable to catch
technical challenges. Okay. I'm just saying that those upsides are not included. This picture excludes imports, and it also includes South Africa coming to the party and saving 10% in terms of electricity. If that happens, that picture becomes even better. So this is just detail now to elaborate on those demand-side interventions in the time frame. As I indicated, we have a short, medium, and long-term sort of plan. And I also reflected on the fact that in the immediate term, it's mostly demand-side interventions that bear fruit. Now, what is the first thing? Demand reduction is the first thing. And that happens in terms of three processes, if you like. Firstly is that load shedding allows Eskom to save the system. Right? In other words, saving against total collapse of the system and making sure that we recover from that risk is, you know, an immediate measure that needs to be brought on board. And then secondly is the issue of power rationing. In other words, fixed scheduled load shedding for a period of just under 4 months, and then later on, the issue of quota allocation, whereby South Africa would be required to comply with a certain quantity of electricity. In other words, you must use the quantity that has been allocated in terms of that quota. In a little bit more detail, Chair, I have mentioned the issue of incandescent lights. That's just one of the measures, and I'll go into some detail as to the regulatory interventions that have been put on the table to facilitate all of this. Energy efficiency in government and state-owned buildings. You know, charity begins at home, Chair. We're saying that there's a lot of upside in government buildings and other state-owned buildings in the way of inefficient lighting, the fact that lights, you know, are left burning in the night and so on, which I won't go into the detail, but for example, we also say that one wants to go into an environment in South Africa where building regulations compel people to be more energy efficient. Solar water heating, specification and standards that relate to the way that we build our houses to save electricity. Then we're talking about an intensive consumer awareness campaign. So there would be a more intensified blitz going forward about energy efficiency to educate the youth, educate the children in the schools, to educate the general population about the importance of saving electricity, but also in the context of load shedding, making them aware of when it will happen and so on, so that they can plan their lives better, but also making them an integral part of sorting out this problem. So this is just a lot of detail about, for example, tariffs. I mentioned the fact that electricity in South Africa is cheap and it is taken for granted. This is a very important intervention that we believe needs to be put on the table. I also need to emphasize that we are not saying that the cost of electricity, or rather electricity, would become inaccessible to the poor. Chair, I need to emphasize that we have free basic electricity policy in this country, which allows us to provide the basic needs of the poor. It is more, us, the consumers, with 50 lights in their houses that are burning throughout the night, because it is affordable for us, that we need to change the tariff to reflect that cost. Okay, Chair, I won't go into more detail than that. And then, Chair, the power conservation phase. Now, the power conservation phase, if you recall, is that we said that in terms of the three-phase approach, in the short term, we're going to do certain things. This is a graphical representation of the picture since January, where we needed to move from about 4,000 megawatts to about 3,000 megawatts in order to make sure that we do not lose the system or mitigate the risk of losing the system. Now, in terms of this program, we envisage that, you know, the power rationing program, or rather the power rationing process period, would kick start after there is some confidence in the fact that, you know, the system, the risk of losing the system has been minimized. I think there might be some elaboration. I don't know if my colleagues from SPA see that. But I think suffice to say that, you know, we envisage a program, or rather a sustained saving of about 1,000 megawatts minimum going forward. Ideally, 3,000 megawatts that we should be conserving. Now, what does all of this mean, Chair? 10% is the target. It allows us to accommodate growth. It's important to mention, Chair, that you might have read in the newspapers that, or rather, it might have been, you know, falsely indicated in the newspapers that South Africa is not in the growing phase. We still are a growing economy. Or rather, that South Africa does not want to grow in the context of electricity shortages. I think the message needs to be very clear that we believe that this is a temporary problem, and the fact that there is a problem about load shedding at the moment does not mean that we should not have investment in the economy going forward. So this strategy is designed to accommodate that growth at the same time as making sure that we keep supply and demand in balance. Chair, there is an envisaged penalty incentive scheme. I'll try and conclude on that line later on, in terms of which we would want to make sure that people who do not comply, right, people who waste energy, for example, that they incur penalties, severe penalties, even to the extent that they are named and shamed for those that repeat their offense and so on. But obviously, you know, we need to make sure that that can be done in the context of, you know, regulatory prudency, and that's what we're working on. In terms of what we're hoping to achieve, is that there is an upside of about 23,000 gigawatt hours per annum that could be saved should South Africa come to the party. And maybe we should appeal to everybody to assist in that regard. I won't go into the penalty incentive scheme, Chair. I think suffice to say that it's work in progress because of those issues that I have mentioned. We're still working on the regulatory revamp in order to facilitate all of this. Chair, institutionally, while certain interventions are already happening at the physical level, we're saying that everything needs to be facilitated in terms of the law, and the process is underway. you might already be aware of the fact that we've published, the Department of Minerals and Energy has published some regulations for public comment relating to energy efficiency and demand side management in the sector. And I just want to give some examples of what we envisage going forward. Is that, for example, all new houses above a certain size, 300 square meters, we believe these are, you know, chair appropriate thresholds, 300 square meters must have solar water heating going forward. It's an integral part of it. So you can't build a house in the future which has an electric heater and does not have a solar water facility. And so on. So I won't go into much more detail on that one, but for example, we're saying that in terms of electric heater, they will be required to be fitted with a facility to remotely switch the electricity supply to it. For an example, when there is a problem with the supply, it is prudent practice, we believe, to have all geysers switched off for all it's worth, because it does not help us. You know, we're all sitting in the offices now, but as we're sitting here, we're consuming electricity back at home with our geysers coming on and off as they become, just keep the water temperature at a certain level. In terms of lighting, or in respect of lighting, Chair, I've mentioned the issue about trying to restrict the use of incandescent lighting. Chair, it is not an outright ban. We need to emphasize that. We understand that some applications require incandescent lighting to be used. What we're saying is that in terms of residential usage, we would want to limit that usage and rather prefer more energy efficient lighting and so on. And then even more significantly, and I think this will also touch on a big part of the sector, electricity sector, which is the municipal sector, is non-fuel standards that relate to reticulation services. For example, insofar as street lighting is concerned, insofar as encouraging municipalities to pass bylaws prohibiting certain practices that are currently happening, we see that as an opportunity that needs to be taken advantage of. And Chair, I will conclude on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think at least we have clarified, as we have a picture now of what has been taking place in terms of interventions made as applied. Probably Enterprise can add something. So let me allow you to add something before I allow the committee in the item.
Thank you, Chair. The one slide that we didn't show, I mean, I think one of the slides that Umbi indicates is where you, if you had a 10% reduction in demand, you would be able to actually a lot quicker get out of the current crisis that we are in, I think is actually quite crucial. The one slide that we didn't show, which is an indication of what's the price differential for electricity between South Africa and the next competitive countries, we remain one of the cheapest economies. A year ago, the differential between us and the next cheapest was about 30% in 2006. By 2007, this had increased to about 70% of the differential. Now, one of the pieces of work that we've asked to be done to make the point that the energy efficiency is not a characterization of the South African economy is to look at what's the energy efficiency of South Africa on the whole, looking at the amount of electricity per unit of GDP that comes out of South Africa. Because that is actually quite a crucial point. In effect, the argument that we are making is no matter how much you build, even if you could build quickly, and some of the constraints on building quickly are the ability to get in equipment on time. And that's not a function of whether Eskom is building or not building. Even when it is the private sector that's building, the difficulty with which the private sector is going to be able to meet the obligations on equipment suppliers around the world, I think it's going to be a significant constraint, and we're quite worried about that. So the core issue is that even if you could bring in a huge amount of capacity into the South African system, if prices don't reflect cost, you're not going to have energy efficiency or efficient utilization in the South African economy. So you're constantly going to be chasing a margin, which is almost difficult to meet. If we don't have the 10% reduction, we actually get out of the situation that we're in around 2012, 2013. Am I correct? Yeah. It's possibly, yes, Brian will talk probably a bit. It's possibly longer than the 2012, 2013 period, because that's when in 2012 we start getting to see additional large chunks of capacity, which is baseload coming to the system. So the core point is, if you don't have a significant reduction in consumption, and it's a baseload reduction in consumption of 10%, which means that it's permanently off the system. It's not a 10% reduction that people will then come back and demand additional capacity as you get more megawatts into the system. So it's a significant problem that we have to deal with going forward. But we do think that if we did have more efficient utilization of electricity, we would be out of the situation. So one of the projects that we are working on between DLE, DPE, DTI, ESCOM, is to look at the replacement program of geysers in households. And over a period, we're trying to get 2 million out. If you were able to get 2 million geysers out of households, or to have a conversion from electricity-based heating, you would be able to save about 1,300 megawatts of electricity on a permanent basis. And that's actually quite a crucial target. Quite a lot of work has gone into looking at that. And one of the key constraints that we've got to deal with is the issue of skills to do the installation, because suddenly you have a massive number of installations that would have to happen in the country at one time. The regulations that DME reflect on are actually quite crucial in as far as creating the impetus for households, at least the middle and higher income earners, who are actually the biggest consumers of electricity in the residential, to retrofit their houses. And also a new bylaw which will come in, and a guideline will come in from the Department of Housing, that all new developments would have solar water heaters, are actually going to help quite a lot to change the structure of demand in the residential sector. So quite a lot of work is being done, and I think ESCOM can talk a little bit more about some of the work that they've been doing to try and get to reduce the amount of unplanned outages or unplanned maintenance that we've been having, but then also to have a realistic assessment of, given the growth in demand, the situation that we are in if we don't have a significant reduction in consumption on a permanent basis.
And if I can maybe just add and talk about a few things I'll touch on. Let me just start off talking about the reserve margins and where we're at. It's certainly where we come from is the perspective of surplus capacity in the country. It allows you adequate space to deal with a whole bunch of things, adequate maintenance that you would do, enough time to do maintenance. And what we have seen is the country's demand has significantly grown since 1994. And since 1994, we have made no investments in power plants. And essentially, that's where we ended up with. And the reserve margin that we talk about below 10% at some stage, and that's what we've seen in January, where you have load losses or load shedding, is zero, negative. And what happens in such a tight system is that your opportunity to do maintenance on your system is then very limited. Limit the time to take units out for outages, limit the time to even look at your transmission network for that matter. Going forward, our current bulk program and an assumption of electricity of 4% will require an aspiration reserve margin of 15%, I believe, beyond 2016-2018. So we would need to intervene quickly as an economy. If we all reduce load by 3,000 megawatts, and it's not only a capacity issue, and there's a difference in capacity and the energy that you save, and we take that constantly out of our economy, we certainly create a situation where we immediately create reserve margin, immediately create opportunity for maintenance and time to do maintenance and deal with the issues that we currently have on our plants and meet the demand in a predictable manner. Just to give the committee a sense, if we maintain our daily unplanned maintenance at 1,500 megawatts and have a load reduction that we have asked for of
Please, those who have got cell phones on, they can please switch them off because they really are disturbing. I think this is the second one now that has disturbed them.
And have the load reduction that we've asked for, the 10% we've asked for, we will be able to meet our reserve margins that we require on a daily basis, as well as we would meet the demand. And that's very important. In the peak in January, you know, that unplanned was significantly higher. What the committee must also understand is that because of these the reserve margins, we do all our outages in summer. We do no outages in winter. Why? Because the peak capacity is quite high in winter. So we do all our planned outages in summer. And we try and squeeze the planned outage requirement that we have over a year into roughly about 7 months. So on an average, we would have 5,000 megawatts of plant out on planned outages. And that's correct. That's what we should do. If you then have a situation of unplanned outages in excess of this 1,500 that I've mentioned, then you have a situation where you just cannot meet the demand. And hence the need for the country to deal with the demand reduction. It's crucially important. I think the committee needs to note that. Going forward, where are we at with our current plant? Our plant is about its midlife, plus midlife, 20, 30 years old. Our plant has been running. When we had excess reserve margin, we used to run our plant on what we call a load factor, that's a utilization factor, on average about 65%. And at 65%, our expectation in terms of our unplanned outages was less than 3%. We planned on 3%. And what we're currently doing, the plant is running a lot harder. It's running in excess of 75% load factors. The expectation for the plant's unplanned outages is closer to 5%. That gives you 2,000 megawatts on average every day for the whole year. On one, any one day, you may have a lot more. So that's the position that we're in terms of our system. Going forward, we have a program as Eskom to deal with this. Always had it. We've accelerated that. And we have invested in that. This doesn't happen overnight. We have responded very quickly in terms of our capacity issues, which is open cycle gas turbines we built in the Cape. We said we built 1,000 megawatts before winter last year. We've done that. It's commissioned. It's working. And that's why the country had no load shedding in the last winter. We have aggressively gone ahead and dealt with the new baseload power stations that require. They start adding big energy. The fastest we can do that is the first units we unload by 2012. We have secured the equipment, the work has started, and for both plants we've secured the equipment. Now, the challenge is on what our colleague from DME has put on the table. The introduction of the private players is important, and we fully support that as Eskom. We will facilitate making sure that that happens. The projections that we have on there, and that's been posted there, is extremely aggressive as far as I'm concerned. Because the limitations that we have, everybody else has access to equipment. Everybody else in the world is building the same plant. I can promise the committee that's happening not only in South Africa, but in Europe and in America, not to talk about China and India. And there's a significant constraint in terms of equipment supply. So getting a big baseload plant from a private player by 2012, if we get it right, excellent. I think it's very aggressive. Getting cogeneration is very important, and we will drive for that. Again, very aggressive projections in terms of what the private players must do in coming into the market to meet with us. It is very important for us as a country to introduce those private players. It makes sense. We can deal with this by the end of 2018. But at the same time, as a country, deal with the 3,000 megawatt reduction and find that, and continue our implementation around demand-side interventions. Specific focus around lighting, the use, the pricing incentives to deal with use, as well as solar water heating. There's a big opportunity for us to focus on it. If we have these things focused and change the culture, and change the behavior, then we can deal with it. There's no reason why the country can't deal with it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think you have really clarified us in terms of where things are. and I'll allow now the committee probably to interact with you. But just before I allow the committee, I understand China is building one of the biggest energy supply, which is going to cost about 118,000. It's going to be about 118,000 megawatts using putting together dams, big dams, hydroelectricity. So artificially, you can generate hydroelectricity from mobilizing water and generating hydroelectricity.
Elaborate. China's got an impressive program. They add about an Eskom every year. They have on the Yangtze River three gorgeous power stations. Impressive. Massive dams across, I think it's the third or fourth biggest river in the world. And they build these turbines in that river. I think it's about 28 of them. It's about 20,000 megawatts. That's run up river out of that. As a country, we don't have a lot of water. We don't have rivers like that. We have small hydros. We focus on pump storage schemes. The only opportunity such as that available in Africa would be the Inga River in the DRC.
But I don't know the waves, because we're surrounded by the ocean, the wave energy generation.
I think these things are important that we do the development. None of that has been proven yet in terms of the scale of what we need. We need, as a country, big baseload power stations that can give energy for most of the day. We have three options to deal with it. If we had natural gas, we can deal with it. If we have coal, we can deal with it. It takes more than 4 years to build a coal plant. The other option is nuclear. That deals with that requirement. Takes us, if we're very successful and we start construction, have all the permits in place, if we stop, it will take us between 7 and 8 years to build it.
I'll allow the members, but in terms of nuclear, the problem is capacity. We don't have expertise enough. We use a lot of money getting consultants to do it for us, which is also very wasteful. We have to think about also that. Yeah. Okay, let me allow members to interact. I've got Mashaba, I've got the Honorable Tinto, Matibela, Galega in that order. Oh, there are two. Okay, let me move on a row. Let's move like that. And then, yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the first thing that one wants to say is the fact that we are very passionate about our role and responsibility as this committee. And we would always like to be very responsible in execution of the same responsibility. And I'm saying this in the context of probably finding ourselves having to rely on hearsay. That's the first one. That we've been unfortunate as this committee. That some of the details that we're getting today, some of the information has already been out there in the newspaper, of which that has been very disturbing to us as the committee. That sometimes you'll find that there could be misquotes, and we are involved in a political world where some people may even exploit the very same information that comes out in the newspaper for political gain. Yet we've got this democratic responsibility that we find ourselves not being able to use effectively for us to allay some of those misquotes and misinformation. Comrade Chair, one can now see that there is enough information to show that partly the growth of the economy of the country has contributed. Secondly, there have been plans that the government has had, and this means that somehow we are no more as sure whether this will still proceed as would have been expected. One, start thinking of the 2012 goal of universal access, which we promised our people out there, as to whether is this not going to be jeopardized because of, although I'm not sure, of which I think one ends up not being sure whether to say it's a crisis, or it's a setback, or it's an emergency. I'm sure ESCOM and the both departments should be able to clarify that for us, so that we could be able to put the record straight if, for one reason or the other, we find that people exaggerate. But that could be done almost in the similar way as it has happened now. It's sometimes too difficult for one to defend something that you don't have that privileged information about. The other area that one needs to clarify upon is we have the understanding that we do export some of, or we've been helping our neighboring countries with their energy supply. And probably we've also been importing some of the energy. If we can get more information around that in the context of the presentation, because if you look there, it's not necessarily what we're getting from outside, it's what we're selling to the neighboring country. Comrade Chair, I think the other one is the issue of skills. There's this racial undertow that has been expressed by some of the members of this parliament, where the issue of skills is an issue that has been racialized. Is there really a possibility that it's because of the skills that we are in this situation? And we would like to see that being addressed in such a way that even in future, we cannot be quoted to have been irresponsible. And the last one is the program that should be going along with this one, where we look at probably one, looking at the issue of job losses, the issue of crime that could be on the increase, probably when there are no lights, that people will always take advantages. And also the sometimes the loss of jobs. If I could just hold it there.
I'm sorry, record the answers, Linda. Actually, once members have presented themselves, according to the law, as I said.
Thank you, Chairperson. Sorry about that. I just want to thank the ME for coming to the rescue. I think this is a very serious problem. Maybe we don't have crisis, but it's a serious problem because it affects especially the very poor communities that rely on electricity, because other sources of energy are very scarce, but electricity is used more very largely. Now, the poor households, especially during this low period, I think what is more important is that people need to be notified but at certain times there will be load shedding. I don't think people will say it's a problem, but I'm sure people need to be made to understand that there is a shortage of electricity and people have to pay for whatever we do. But also there will be plans to save jobs, especially in the mining companies. Is there any plan? Because I don't think Eskom understands the problem like we do. Maybe they do, but they don't take this committee very seriously. But we've been trying to have meetings with Eskom. But up until now, we never had a meeting with Eskom. That's why I say I thank the CME for this forward planning. But education is more important. Because if it starts here and ends here, it's not going to help. But the communities out there need to be informed. Thank you, Chair. I'm sure the other comrades also want to have a fight. But I think it's a very informative meeting, this one.
But to recognize that public enterprise is also here.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I've got three questions. Two of them are backward-looking, and the third one is to the future. The first question, in your presentation on page 7, we look at the January 28th supply-demand situation. We see that, you know, the black week, as we can call it, from Monday the 14th to Thursday the 24th, it's actually longer than a week, but let's call it the black week. That, you know, you explained to us that the peak period is in winter, we understand that, and therefore you do your maintenance in summer. All very well and fine. But we all know that the economy, especially in Gauteng, and that's the heart of the engine room of the economy, really kicks back at about exactly that time, the 14th of January, when people, the schools are opening and people, you know, resume their normal commercial and industrial activities. And that's when the blackout. Was it not possible, if you consider to actually do maintenance work in the month prior to that, when it was a more quiet period? The second question was, the next page 8, you talked about the coal quality, you talked about the rain and so on and so forth, you've covered the rain issue. But the coal quality, you say we've got poor coal quality. But has the quality of coal in South Africa suddenly dropped? Has it deteriorated? Have we not always had the same poor quality of coal? So wasn't that a given factor? Mr. Chairman, and then my third question, more to the future, is of a very serious concern. That's the growth, economic growth, and especially job creation, or rather the lack of job creation, which is tied to economic growth. My question to Eskom is it correct or is it true, will you confirm that Eskom will no longer issue certificates for new construction projects over the next couple of months? If this is correct, for how long do you envisage this moratorium on new development, new projects? And how do you envisage this impact on economic growth? How many jobs will be lost? And so on. And just to clarify that, you talked about this, you know, we have to constrain or reduce the usage, the consumption of power. Sure, we understand that. But that is definitely in contradiction or incompatible with growing the economy. On the one hand, we've got to reduce usage, and if we want to still grow the economy, we can't actually reduce the usage of the consumption of power. Could you please elaborate on that? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a general remark, I would just like to add that the amount of spin doctrine on this issue, which has been turned by government itself an emergency or a crisis situation, has never been seen before. If you look at page 4 of the handout, you will see that since at least 2000, Eskom should have had, and in fact did have, a day-to-day, if not an hourly, feedback as to what the growth in demand was. And if it is to be accepted that by 2007, as we experienced, we were running out of power, and in fact ran out of power, why wasn't the policy, whatever it was at 2000, not re-established, revisited. Because if you accept that fact, that it takes 5 to 7 years to build a new power station, then at least by 2000, you should have instructed an IPP or instructed ESCOM to proceed with the build of a new power station. It cannot be otherwise. Now, if that is a point of departure, my concern is the following. We have an aging generation power unit, or generating power unit. And you've said that in the midlife, 20 to 25 years, I'm not so sure. I think the majority of some of those power stations are closer to 30 years. I do not recall any build since 1990, which would at least give some of those stations now 18 years, like a large build. So you could accept that the majority of them are around about 30 years. Now, if you accept that by 2015, the majority of these stations would be in excess of 30 years, what about if you are only targeting the growth, the possible growth, what about the possibility or the inevitability, rather, of the current generating capacity being taken offline, not only due to planned dates, but also due to unforeseen circumstances? We've seen unforeseen circumstances come to play with the general running of these power stations. Now, you know, I don't want to venture an opinion, I'm not an engineer, but isn't it possible that some of these power generating units could go offline and be taken offline sooner because of the fact that they're being run so much harder, and therefore their lifetime in terms of cycle, life cycle, is then decreased? It cannot be other. It cannot be otherwise, if I understand the logistics and the logic of what you explained. So that's the other issue. There's a growing demand, and somewhere you have to start planning for the taking off of some of these generating stations. And the only way, in my view, to do it is, except for your increased building plan, which you are now embarking upon, is to allow RPPs co-generation at an increased scale than to what you are now even proposing. The IPPs is an issue which there are, as I understand, an IPP ready and willing, and depending on what the decision is by ESCOM, in particular Botswana, and more particular Mamabolo, to conclude a contract with ESCOM. And, you know, there seems to be some hold-up of some kind, and I can only suspect, I can't say this, I can only suspect it has inter alia to do with the pricing of that future purchasing of electricity. Now, if it's not so, you see you shaking your head, and please tell me what is the concerns as to why that contract is not being concluded, because in my view that can only be in light of your own forward plan. The crisis together with the taking off of certain units can only be met by IPPs, co-generation, and a few other issues. Then, on the other issue of, there's been talk about an advisory team, and I'm not sure to whom to address this, with ESCOM or DME or DPE, but there's been talk of an advisory team to Cabinet, a multidisciplinary advisory team. Has that task team been established? If so, who are they? Have they sat? Have they advised government? Have they advised ESCOM? Is it an advisory team to ESCOM, or is it an advisory team to Cabinet as particular, or government? Do we have more details on that? Then, in particular, to the solar watering heating devices. There seems to be a lot of ideas punted around, but when it comes to the practicality of importing, of accrediting these companies, of ensuring that there's a regulatory framework, which is, of course, one of the issues concerning IPPs, and the alleged failure of inviting or getting IPPs to invest in the market is the dominant by ESCOM in the power generating market. Now, what is being done, A, to facilitate solar water heating devices, companies, accreditation, and creating a regulatory environment within which IPPs, solar water heating companies, and many more kind of different energy generating sources can be accommodated. For the moment, I think that's all. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. The first question is, you know, the lady who said when she made an addition about Eskom and this story we've had for such a long time, that Eskom is providing the cheapest electricity in the world, one of the cheapest in the world. I'm just saying, I hope that is not a situation that because of all these problems of supply, you're going to increase and so on and so forth. Because the point is that whenever people say we are the cheapest in the world, and you ask, who's this world that you're talking about? In most cases, you're referring to first world countries. And the point is that to use first world countries as a standard bearer all the time, at times it's such a ridiculous thing to do, because to be honest, it isn't American citizens that are buying electricity from the country, it's South Africans. So this, whatever the price is must be determined according to affordability in South Africa. I mean, already you can see a lot of people can afford. That's why we have indigent policies in this country. So I'm just saying to you, be careful. And the analysis of we are the cheapest in the world, you should be very careful about that, because you're not applying to America, to Britain, to Germany. You're applying to South Africans. And per capita income is not the same. You can't tell me somebody on the average per capita income, say, in Britain where it is, £1,000, and in South Africa, on the average, it is 500 or 1,000 rand. You can compare the two. So the point I'm making is that before you start to change prices and so on in South Africa, don't go and look at America, because to be honest, they are not buying from us. It is South Africans who must buy this electricity. And strictly speaking, look at them. Their affordability. The basic and twist to structure is such that the rich can be taxed more, can pay more than the poor. Because if you're going to make it expensive, it is going to defeat the purpose. People won't just afford it, and South Africa will be a dark city, simply because people can afford it. I just thought we should make that point, because you repeatedly make that point as if you are warning us that there's going to be increase. And the second point I want to make is, and I would ask the department, if you can answer questions, maybe sell them to Eskom, because we are happy to be here today. But the second question is, you know, it is good to give us all those analysis, but if you don't give us the total picture, it becomes a problem. For example, we are told that consumers consume about 15% of total electricity, I mean residents. And then mining is 17%, agriculture is 12%, and manufacturing is 37%. So I assume 19% is commerce. Now the point is that you need to show us, I mean, you've just spoken about the residents, which is 15%. I mean, what about other sectors of the economy? Because that total analysis is going to be important in you deciding, answering the question, are we going to stop economic growth because we don't have electricity? Are we going to tell people who want to build shopping complexes and so on and say stop until 2012 because we'll have enough electricity in 2012? I don't think you're going to be in a position to stop economic growth. The best you can do is to strategize and say, for example, mining melters are consuming more electricity because you need concentrated heat there, but they are employing few people. So if you need to kind of focus on where to save, you can save there, because you know they don't create jobs. And you can't do it on mining directly, because mining employs more people. So I'm just saying, you know, that total strategy of different sectors in the economy is very important, so that you must know where you are saving and where you are focusing and concentrating your saving, and where you are not concentrating, and what the reasons are. The last point I want to make is again on the power station. Since already there's a power station there. It was there from 1918. And we've asked, how many power stations do we have in the country that are inactive? And how long will it take to inactivate you? Because the solution we're looking for is a short-term solution. And if power stations are there, you know, in my constituency, if you tell them, no, we're running short of power stations, they say, come, we'll take you to Pimville, there's a power station there. And it isn't working. Why don't you get it to work? So the point is, can you activate this power station and how long will it take? Last time we were told they are doing an assessment through local government as to how many power stations are there. But up to now, we didn't get an answer. The last thing, I don't want to take much of your time. I'm also interested in the wave generation of electricity, because to be honest, we must look at all these alternatives. In the radio yesterday, Radio SAFM, 7 o'clock news, 8 o'clock news, they told us Stellenbosch University is behind it, and they are generating, they're looking at generating electricity because indeed we do have a lot of ocean. From Eastern Cape, Western Cape, up to Devon, they can generate electricity. We hear these things in the news, but officially, from credible institutions like Eskom or our DME, we don't hear a thing. I mean, is the hope there or what is happening? Thanks.
I'll ask members also to summarize because they will also run short of time.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think maybe I should begin by saying South Africans have been very kind. And I think through this difficult time, they have shown that they are tolerant. And we saw electricity still taken for granted because it's a matter of putting a switch on. And especially in urban areas, in rural areas, it's much more difficult because we kind of used to the outages for many years because we've had inferior electricity supplies in those areas. But my concern is that I'm not sure the planning in Eskom. I doubt it. Because why were those power plants shut down in the first place? And one of the reasons from my side is that we didn't, development has occurred after 1994. And then if those power plants were prefabricated, were made new, were put new technology into them, we wouldn't be in the position we are in today. It was bad planning. And I still need someone to tell me otherwise. The other serious issue is that people, we've been taken for granted, especially this committee. We have been seriously neglected. We've been kept in the dark. And if we, because we read from the newspapers, and just imagine that this committee, who's supposed to know, what about the rest of the community, our constituencies? They know more than that because they're reading the same thing in the paper. So I must say that I feel very strongly about this, that in future we should be put into the know. And I didn't hear anything about nuclear today because we spend megabucks on what we're going to do in the future. And nothing has been said up to now. And we all know that it's a very serious issue. And we should be told about it. The cheap coal issue, that's what we survived with in the past, that our power station is cheap coal. And when cheap coal becomes a problem, it becomes questionable. Well, then why don't we use the export coal? Stop the export. Put it in there. We should use those coal we're using for export. Because, I don't think. And may I ask, what's happening to the Mozambique power? And the Botswana power station that has been set up. What is happening there? Can someone explain? And then I think there are issues which we should also look at. I'm strong on the solar heat, water heating, and I've been there from 1994. I've said this every meeting. I said, why aren't we doing this? We should start with the government buildings. And it's just been put aside. The other thing, we have such an advantage in our country with so much sunshine. Why do we not look at daylight saving? Why can't we divide our country into two time zones? That would be an immediate saving. Immediate. We would not, and we can do it, because you go to Rwanda, you have a different time zone from us. You go to Nairobi, there's a different time zone. Why can't we just divide our country into half? And that, I can tell you, will be the best way and the easiest way to go. I thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Most of the questions have already been covered, but the issue that I want to raise is around consumer education. After the briefings we got this morning, I am positive that we'll manage, provided that each one of us contribute in saving electricity. So my question is, I am of the view that the different stakeholders should be embarking on a massive consumer education campaign, not just concentrating on households, but on everybody who's using electricity in this country. Because if we do that, we can definitely reach the 7-year focus capacity margin and everything that they are talking about on slide 15. But my issue is, let us see the stakeholders rolling out a consumer education campaign to make sure that the people in our constituencies are aware of what each one of us can contribute in saving electricity. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I was number two. Now I'm almost number last. And now all my questions have been taken. I've got just I would like to say I understand the reduction of usage of energy. I welcome that. The only thing that I would like to know is the energy bulbs, which are very good savers. But the most difficult part of it is, we know that our people, most people, are poor, unemployed, but then these bulbs are very expensive. They are no good for poor people. And the other one, I just want to know, can't it be made cheaper? Yes, the minister told us that with the saving part, they are going to roll out those bulbs. Meanwhile, waiting, can't they also be made cheaper? Because some of the people won't be able to get to the point where they can access those free bulbs. And the other one is it's a request on the bylaws. I'm just hoping that those bylaws are not going to say we must put the lights out at night, then we are saying to the housebreakers, welcome home. Because it will be dark when they come there, nobody will see them. The other one which I did not hear was I saw in a paper that, I don't remember well which smelter was going to be closed, but I didn't hear anything about that, about the smelter. And I was just going to say, like what Honorable Mashaba said, job losses. Because those people will be unemployed. And to have some of them, that's the only source of income working in that smelter. Thank you, Professor.
So, for information, to remind you, it's the smelter in Richards Bay that is going to close and shed some jobs. Nomsa wrote to us about that. I'm sure that's what you are trying to say.
Firstly, I must apologize for being late. I was in the Chief Whip's forum. But obviously this is a topic I don't want to miss, so I have rushed over here. I didn't have the benefit of sitting through your entire presentation, but I have read through some of the slides. Two points that I want to make, in just in terms of the kind of current crisis and the causes behind it. The one point is that certainly we didn't build enough generating capacity, and that's been accepted by everyone. The other thing is that there were outages caused by problems at Eskom at some of its power stations because of coal quality and the like. The issue for me, though, is that, you know, we hear these different stories coming out. We hear these different scenarios trying to buy Eskom. What I actually think is that this has been a major failure in oversight. And actually, I think Parliament itself needs to take some blame for this, too. I think that what we have seen here is a major failure in oversight to ensure that we can continue providing electricity. And I think we've all been kept in the dark on this, so to speak. And what I would propose, actually, is that we need some kind of an independent commission of inquiry to look into precisely what the causes are behind all of this, but also to look in terms of future planning. Because what I'm seeing now is a whole bunch of plans being put forward, a whole bunch of money committed towards future energy plans. But, you know, where is the consultation over this? Where is the consultation over spending 700 billion rand on nuclear build? Where, you know, which is a prerogative in terms of the white paper in 1998. You know, so I don't want to see us jump into a kind of knee-jerk reaction and leading to other problems down the line. And that's just my one point from there. The other thing is that the minister also said that the developmental electricity pricing program will remain. Now, I just want clarity on this, because if we are honestly going to persist with the developmental electricity pricing program, which sells the electricity at very cheap prices to very energy-intensive users and attracts them to our country, then we've got a major problem. I mean, I really don't think that it's a snap in the face to us ordinary South African citizens to conserve energy so that we can sell it at rock-bottom prices to energy-intensive users. And I just want some clarity on that point. The other issue is, what we've also seen is that Eskom, the problems here have also been caused by a very centralized energy system. Eskom is basically in charge of almost all our electricity production in South Africa. So we are very beholden to you. And the reason why we haven't seen the cogeneration and we haven't seen the renewable energy is we haven't really been serious about this. I mean, I don't think Eskom has really had any kind of firm drive towards these type of projects. My argument is that why are we giving the power to Eskom again to be in charge of doing the cogeneration? Surely the feasible thing to do would be to simply introduce the feed-in tariff, put the prices out there, and force Eskom to buy the energy from them like we do in other countries around the world. This is the way that we can start to break the kind of stranglehold that Eskom has. And I would like to hear what your comments are on that. The other thing with regards to the solar water heaters, I mean, I have strong reservations about whether we will actually be able to roll out a million solar water heaters in the next 3 years. I think a straight subsidy scheme might bring down the price of solar water heaters from 12,000 to 10,000 rand, but that's not enough of an incentive to actually get the uptake from ordinary South African citizens. So the issue is, how are we going to reach a target of 1 million solar water heaters? And quite frankly, you know, even if we had to buy all of the solar water heaters at a cost of 29 billion rand, we'd get an energy saving of 4,500 megawatts, which is more than what we would get from a coal-fired power station. So I think it would be even a better investment. But the issue is, how are we going to get through these type of obstacles in terms of reaching our target of 1 million solar water heaters? Thank you.
Chairperson, and my question is about the unplanned outages. What plans have been made on the improvement of the quality of the coal in South Africa?
Okay, you can feedback. I think members of media are mouthful and can respond. Among yourselves or however, how whatever what they want to respond, doesn't matter, as long as all the input of members is taken care of.
Yes, we'll try and yeah, because we don't have time to sort of like distribute, so we'll cover what we feel is our competence, and if there are those that we've left out, we'll come back to them.
let's start with the first. I suppose it's an apology, but also a request that maybe the chair could help by co-arranging with the chair of the Public Enterprises Portfolio Committee. As ESCOM and as the Department of Public Enterprises reports to the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises, it's at that forum that we've taken all of the issues that relate to ESCOM. It would be useful that if it were possible to have joint sittings between the two committees, because there's no doubt that there is a lot of benefit in being able to jointly brief the two committees. The problem for us is just trying to get to a point where we have a schedule that we can sort of like arrange in a fashion.
We did ask them actually to come today because we asked them in some joint study group, and unfortunately have not been able to be available. Apologizing for the instance, and we thought that that was the best way forward, but unfortunately they were not available.
So I mean, it's not an intention for any disrespect. I mean, in today's case where we had also. To go to SCOPA at the same time as be here. So I think as a principle, I mean, one of the things that as the Department of Public Enterprises has done in order to actually improve the engagement, and we have some fairly rough engagement from the Portfolio Committee, because we've spent the last couple of years getting to a point where I think between them and ourselves, our understanding of the electricity system has actually improved quite a lot, because we actually do autumn schools jointly, where we actually have specialists come in and actually lecture not just only ourselves as the department, but also the committee, so that oversight is able to improve. So I think there are a lot of these kinds of things that we could do jointly quite happily. So let's get to the first point. As I understood the first question, it related to the issue of universal access for electricity connections. In as far as that's concerned, on ESCOM's plans and its ability to deliver on those connections, that remains. But Chair would remember, the Committee would remember, that the funding for that program is a direct fiscal transfer, that for as long as it continues to come into ESCOM, the ability to deliver that remains. Chair may remember that a few years ago, and I'm not sure if the problem got resolved, was an issue of the funds being shifted from the Department of Mineral Energy Affairs, because that's where the money used to go, and into ESCOM, and the money was shifted into the Department of Public, of provincial government, to shift it back into ESCOM. So there was that point where that caused, I think, some sort of challenges in the rollout. But in as far as that's concerned, ESCOM only lives can actually do the amount to the extent that it is funded for the rollout program. Brian will talk a little bit more about the exports and the imports onto the grid. I'd like to come to this question of race. To racialize the issues at ESCOM is, I think, unfortunate, because it is not at all a race question in the case of ESCOM. I mean, if there were serious challenges with race, the power stations that we've delivered up to date would not have happened. I do think, and I think it is the core issue of, it was partly planning on the one hand, probably, but also it's the other. And I think there's been many a times where various ministers, including the president himself, have come in and said that we didn't make decisions about ESCOM both soon enough. It wasn't that there weren't moments to try and bring in IPPs, the private sector, into the system. It wasn't, and I think the commitment that we still have is about bringing private sector players into the industry. Now, having said that, I mean, I think it would be useful for us to be able to move beyond what were the issues and start dealing directly with, now we are where we are. So what do we do now that we are at this particular juncture? I do think it's unfortunate when race is raised as a concern. One of the areas that ESCOM is spending a lot of money, and DME and BPE, in conjunction with all the other SOEs, is increasing the investment that we're making on the skills building side, because it's a challenge that just doesn't only exist in ESCOM, it exists in the whole economy, to bring in sufficient skills to be able to deliver on the BOE program that we have as state-owned enterprises, but also the BOE program that companies like SEFL and the rest of the like would have in South Africa. I think it's something that we all worry about. To come to the job losses and the job shedding, I mean, I'm trying, the mining question is really a big concern. By Monday afternoon, we had received at least the initial list of how much capacity all of the mines needed to get back to. However, the list didn't include every single mine. There were two or three mines that had indicated that they needed a few days for them to come back to Eskom to indicate the total capacity that they would require to come back onto the system, so that by the end of the week we'd be able to come back to them, agree on how much they could come back, because the question of retaining system stability is a crucial one. I think I've remained quite conscious of the fact that we must ensure that there are no job losses that arise out of this exercise. But by the end of the week, we should be able to come back. We've been in discussions as well with NUM at the same time, so that there is one message that comes out by the end of the week. Maybe this.
No, by the way, they are here.
Let me just deal with the issue around the exports to our neighbors. Two big customers outside of South Africa that we export power to. The first one is the North in Mozambique, close to 900 megawatts. And then there's another big customer. We have essentially long-term contracts with those. We have firm contracts, supply contracts, some of our neighboring countries. And really the amount of energy that they use is pretty minimal. It's not even 3% of our system. And the highest would be a firm contract just over 300 megawatts with Botswana. And that's it. And our firm commitment, as we deal with load shedding in South Africa, similarly, those contracts are impacted with our neighboring countries. But we should not forget as a country. The committee has raised Botswana. The committee has raised Mozambique. That we currently import a significant amount also from Mozambique through Cabarabasa. So we cannot as a country believe that we're going to cut our neighbors off and that we're a net exporter. Some of these solutions in our future lies within our neighbors. And therefore it's very important that with Eskom we stick to our commitments, that as we have load shedding in South Africa, that we apply that as well. But this picture is distorted by the big customers that we would export to where we have long-term contracts with the smelters. So that is the situation. So if we would export just 900 megawatts to Mozal in Mozambique, we could import from Cabarabasa over 1,200 megawatts. So we should be very careful around that. The issue on skills. Eskom currently has got some of the best skills in this country that has been grown over a long period of time. And guess what? They look like this country. All peoples of this country that equally good and equally skilled and have been running the system. You will not find anybody else from anywhere else in the world that will come in and replace 30,000 Eskom people and solve this problem. It's not going to happen. So I can promise you, the IPPs that we're going to get, they're going to get the people from Eskom. That's where they're going to start looking at. Actually, other utilities in the world have already started recruiting out of Eskom. So we currently, one of our biggest challenges, how do I pay somebody enough money to not for him to take a job in the UK and get pumped? And guess what? They're white, they're black, and they're all colored. And as a country, we should be proud of the skill set that we have both. And as management and Eskom, I think we would ask everybody that the 30,000 people out there is the ones that have to solve this problem, nobody else. And if everybody can support them, that will certainly be helpful in terms of them executing their role. I personally have been in Eskom in 21 years. Have worked through this country from the bottom to the top. Now, I guess if you put a white person next to me, we'd be equally confident, aren't we? Unless we say that that's not the case. So, if we go forward to the issues around maintenance in the January month, we do most of our maintenance in the summer months. We have to use all the summer months. In December, we certainly have a situation where most construction industries are closing down and people are not available. But we do work during December as well, as required. But we just don't have enough summer months to do all the maintenance that is required. So we have to use January, we have to use, and the maintenance starts tapering off towards May as we move into winter. So it's not an option to start earlier. The issue around poor coal, the quality of coal to Eskom has been deteriorating over some time, and over the last few years certainly have seen a step change increase in terms of it being higher ash, less heat value, higher abrasiveness. Those are significantly impacting our power plants. A lot of the effects of the poor quality coal are delayed. They come in a lot later. And it's very important strategically for us, and DME has dealt with that, as a country, to deal with better coal. Because if we have this plant that's older, and if we put something good in it, we hopefully can get it running better and longer. So that's key and very important, and we will address that going forward. And that's very important. We can't use all the export coal. Our power stations are not designed to both burn all the export coal. It will create other problems. But some of that, blended with the current supply, will certainly assist and make sure that we have a better situation.
There was then the question that was asked around the agree entirely that on the load shedding, when unavoidable, better planned schedule, clear notification so that people are able to preempt, they're able to plan their lives around it, is actually essential. It's one of the things that we will be coming out with. However, what remains a challenge in efficient scheduling is that Eskom can tell you or can tell a municipality that Duguza, you will be out from 10 to 12 on Tuesday. But Duguza can't assure you always that you, the individual consumer on the other side, will actually be out at 10 to 12 because the age of the distribution network in South Africa is so variable. So an automated system would be able to switch off at the same time that Eskom switched them off, and they're able to switch you back on at the same time that Eskom would switch them back on. Most of the systems are much older than that, and in effect, in most municipalities, we find that the municipality has to get into a car and switch off manually at different points, and that creates its own problem in terms of then designing, in a sense, an alternative, an overlay schedule over the Eskom schedule. The Eskom schedule is basically going to say, you'll be out in this area from this time, and then you need the municipality to plan another schedule, which would then reflect their ability to take you out and their ability to bring you back onto the system. Now, we have been talking to the Department of Local Public Provincial, DPLG, I also use it in acronym, to help us with the coordination of all of the provinces as well as all of the municipalities, so that in a sense we start doing the same thing that Joburg has done, where they've created their own schedule, which they've now distributed to people. So it's quite a big issue, and we are really focusing a lot of energy on that. The economic effects of this, none of us are able to say as we sit in today. However, what we have looked at in 2003 or 2004 where Brazil had a significant drought. Now, Brazil's system is dependent on hydro. With the drought, they instituted a 25% quota rationing right across the economy. Everybody had to cut their consumption by 25%. What they found is that on the other side of that 25% cut, the efficiency of the economy increased. Now, Chair, we have that report. We would be quite happy to share with yourself, so that what we've been looking at is trying to see what we can learn from the Brazilian experience to make sure that some of those benefits, which are efficiency benefits, can feed through into the economy. So quite a significant amount of energy has got to go towards that element to ensure that whatever negative effects, because we must anticipate that there will be negative effects in economy, which is as dependent on electricity as our economy would arise. I want to come back to this question of electricity pricing, because everybody does.
I think we must have what. If I just allow anybody to spring from the floor, then we won't be able to finish. Just allow them to finish, and then you can make follow-ups should if we have time.
Not a follow-up, you just skipped one of my questions.
No, but they haven't finished because they said they are sharing the responses.
Chair, the question that I imagine the member wanted to ask about was the connections by Eskom. We'll come back to that because we've tried to sort of like separate out the technical one. But if there is, we'll return to that. Let me come back to this issue of pricing. It is patently unfair, actually, to compare South African electricity prices with less developed economies by virtue of the fact that not many developing countries have a grid as big as South Africa. So let me take one developing economy, which is a manufacturing economy. If you take South Korea and you compare the price of electricity in South Korea to South Africa, South Korea's unit price last year was already 7 US cents per kilowatt hour. That's the generation tariff. Ours was 3 US cents at the time. That's a developing economy. If you take a developing country on the continent of Africa today, a month ago, Rwanda's price of electricity was 20 US cents per kilowatt hour. The point is, you can only really compare South Africa's prices when you look at countries which have baseload fuel, their own fuel. So the countries, sure, that you can try and compare us to is Qatar, where they have gas. They are invariably much cheaper than us, but they don't have a grid as big as our grid directly. So what one tries to do, and cause bearing in mind, and this is a point which we've held to, is that whatever you do on electricity, the first mechanism that you have is you have to have a market clearing instrument of one sort or the other. Prices must reflect cost. However, you want to have a system that does ensure the fact that the poor at the bottom of the scale, who are actually not the huge consumers of electricity, one, number two, who are actually not the wasteful consumers of electricity, are protected as you go forward. Now, I think DME did indicate the free basic electricity issue, which is something that we will have to go and revisit and look at how much is available as free basic electricity, first of all. Secondly, if you recall, I think 15 years ago in South Africa, we introduced the block in-kind tariff for water. So water in South Africa already reflects that principle. So this wouldn't be a new principle that we'd be introducing in South Africa. It's a principle that exists, that there's protection for people who are poor, who are indigent, but that the wealthier, the people who use more electricity, or the people who use more water in this instance, would pay a lot more for water. So this question of equity is actually prime in dealing with this problem as we go forward. In the event, why didn't Eskom build since 2002? There's a white paper which was very clear in saying that there must be private sector players. Eskom can't build additional capacity. It's only 2004 where the decision has changed, where Eskom is told you will build 70% of you build, 30% will be private sector. Members will note that in 2003, the Eskom board, despite the fact that they were told that they can't build, put in a request to bring back to service the mothballed power stations at that period of time. That's why we've been able to see the capacity that we indicated that's actually come in over the last couple of years. So I don't think it's also entirely fair to suggest that Eskom was sitting and doing nothing at the particular juncture. If there was a policy decision that we had taken, and we're living with those consequences of some of those decisions that we took. Now, also one. Secondly, we'd be quite happy, Chair, to come and show you a study that we did with Eskom, which was looking at what had been happening to growth in the demand of electricity over the last 10, 15 years in South Africa. What has been the relationship between GDP growth and electricity growth? Historically, in the last couple of years, the relationship has been GDP growth has been ahead of electricity growth. And so whenever you look at Eskom's bill program that they've had over the last couple of years, it's reflected that relationship. It's only in the last 2 years when ESGISA came out as a program, which targeted a 6% GDP growth rate, we then went back to Eskom and said, can you now assume that the economy is growing at 6% and then show what would be the bills that you require for that? That was presented, that has been presented to the regulator directly as well for approval. So a lot of work has gone into ensure that there is robustness in the demand forecast that we have. Now, the demand forecast that we have also, because the build-up of the model by Eskom is actually sector-based. It doesn't assume that you have some straight relationship. It goes and it looks at what's happening to the mining industry, what's happening in the services sector, is it growing, and the rest of the like. One of the things that's happened in the last couple of years is that there's been a boom in commodities. And because of the boom in commodity prices, it means that what were previously marginal mines suddenly becomes profitable mines. So it's new capacity that just comes into the system. So a lot of work has gone into this, and I think if we continue to refine, we continue to learn. But members must remember this. For every 1% excess capacity that you have, because it's just sitting there as an insurance, there's a cost attached to it, because as users we have to effectively pay for it. And that's why arriving at some sort of balance of 15-19%, and the number that the policy department is now using is 19% of a reserve margin, is what we're working on. But 19% is not for free. It has a cost. And that's the other element that I think we'd be more than happy to come to a session with the committee and indicate what are the costs for every single 1% that you have sitting in reserve, which is correct by and large to enable faster economic growth, but there's a cost in having that kind of capacity, I think.
Sorry, Chair, if I may just latch on to that point about prices and tariffs and just clarify, Chair, I think what he's saying is that at the moment, I think just for the sake of the members, is to understand that it is more the tariff distribution. We talk very loosely about tariff and the fact that the wholesale tariff needs to go up. But what you must remember is that there is a whole structure. In other words, the cost that Eskom passes through to the municipalities, to the key customers, needs to be looked at very critically. It is not fair, and I think that's what the point that the DG from Public Enterprise is trying to say. It is not fair for us to undersell and undercharge the multinationals and the key customers. It is not about charging inequitably. It's a question of us recovering all the costs that we need to recover so that we can subsidize the poor. And that is the point.
If I can, I think, deal with the question that maybe has been missed. We have said quite clearly our connections and applications that were made to us that we have committed to, and that we have committed to and said, yes, we will do that. We would go ahead and honor them. And certainly beyond that, it's something we don't have. And it's very important then that we look at the taking up the 3,000 megawatts constantly with its associated energy out of the demand. And if you look at the graph that DM has put up, if you can do that and you can take our current base where we act with capacity and demand and you can reduce that and take that out totally, we can then still as a country maintain that reserve and then continue to grow at 4%. That gives you the opportunity then to introduce you. But it's very important that all of us come to the table with the initiatives and the plans that has been announced that we achieve that. The aging fleet and the plant. I kind of started my job in the end of 2004, just after Minister Irwin got, and in October, and 1 month later, I got a letter that says Cabinet has decided we should build power stations, and that's why I was brought to do that. We then started that. Just a year earlier, we started the return to service program. Before that, I guess we have told everybody you needed this. Now, when we started this, we have aggressively got on with the job and getting it done. Unfortunately, all of us has kept this too late. And that's the bottom line of it. So, in terms of the existing plant, you're very right. Remember, I've said 20 to 30 years, the last unit only gets commissioned 6-7 years later. So by the end of the 20-year period, we have to start replacing them. Our current plan, in terms of how we maintain our plants and how we invest in them, is to maintain a 50-year life of them. And we have been managing that every year diligently as to how we make investments in key components to maintain that. So that is our expectation. It's very important that we then continue the investment, increase the maintenance of it, and you're very right, the maintenance needs to be increased, and make sure that we maintain that life. But by the end of that period, in addition to adding this new capacity for the new grid, we then have to add capacity to replace the existing plant. And that would be very important. Let me deal with ICTs and cogen. Be very clear, Eskom, we fully support that they come in. And actually, we want to set this record straight once and for all. And also prove to you that they're going to be more expensive than Eskom. Now, let me deal with Mamabula. We have been ready to sign a contract with Mamabula in December. Unfortunately, I cannot, because they're not ready. And we have been waiting since then, and waiting today's call to engage them on that. We have nothing from them to accept or to deal with. But we have a clear mandate from our board as to our negotiations parameters, and those are liberal, and we're ready to deal with that. It is the best developed IPP project that we have currently available of that type. And we're very supportive of it, and if it works, great. But unfortunately, we cannot move forward because they're not ready with that. And the cogen, we have committed that we will drive that aggressively going forward. We have started the process last year, we started the new one this year, and we will certainly drive that aggressively forward.
Question of an advisory team. I'm not personally aware of any such structure. there have been several meetings that we've been have been had, and one of the there is a team that's made up of government departments. It includes BUSA, and I include a couple of unions as well, which is coordinating the response. And it covers, because one of the things that the at least the demand side interventions require is quite a lot of interaction with a lot of government departments. So SAND departments of housing on the building side, but also the SABS on the standard side, and that links up with the question around the importation of solar water heaters. If you are going to be able to meet the timelines, the deadlines that we've set, and we think they're actually quite seriously doable, on condition, the one unfortunate is that you will have imports. We've had meetings with the current, with the geyser manufacturers as well as solar water heater manufacturers in South Africa. There is an indication that you can actually adapt a geyser to a solar water device. The constraint that all of them have indicated to us, that I have indicated, is skill. So we have a project that's also looking to assist them to upskill, because it's an additional 10,000 jobs, actually, that you would immediately create. And that is just dealing with the retrofit. And it's not talking with the remaining 7 to 8 million households that you could still retrofit. Also, we've been pretty careful around the retrofitting, the guidelines that Undu was talking about. You also don't, because when we've done the economics, for low-income households or low consumers of electricity, it isn't profitable to convert your solar water, your geyser into a solar water instrument. It's more than adequate for you to put in a timer onto your geyser, electric geyser, and you find on the grid. It's the large users, actually, where the economics starts to shift quite significantly towards a change being actually in the interest of the consumer more than even being a function of just the system. There is, however, the point that as the system, the point that you make, that the honourable member makes, is that we benefit a hell of a lot if we have people change quickly as opposed to slow, and that's the benefit of an incentive, in that it fast-tracks the change, the conversion by the companies. The education campaign, you're not going to hear any of us denying that. I mean, it's a critical element. And in fact, for many, it's been quite interesting even going through the exercise because, you know, for most of us who come from households where electricity was introduced when we were 10 or 11 years old, you have mothers who said to you that you can't have a cup of water in the kettle. And I mean, I still have to deal with that because suddenly you have a campaign that says, boil one cup of water. I grew up knowing that you can't switch off a geyser because when you switch it back on the system, it's going to use too much electricity. So they accept the fact that there's a lot of work that we've got to do in just educating people so that even ourselves shift from what we understand. And in the meantime, just the switching off of the geyser right now is helpful. Sure, there's a lot of issues around shifting the load because we're actually not off the system, and that's why solar water heaters and that replacement program is a crucial program. ESCOM has actually quite a few years ago looked at this issue of time zone as well as daylight saving. Clearly at the time, the bulk of the economic activity in South Africa was in Gauteng. So there was no benefit of a time zone on the electricity side because that's where the huge chunk of usage. But now with the change in the structure of the economy in the Western Cape and its demand increasing, the economics are starting to change around daylight savings. We've got an initial report which is showing that you could actually get about 200 megawatts of electricity back. But all that does, I'm trying to understand the engineering term. It's not demanded off permanently. You shift the load because the peaks are then at different times. But even that is good enough at this current juncture. Not enough. We still need to do work around what would be the logistics of introducing two time zones and the rest alike. And frankly, as a shareholder representative for SA and SA Express, it's only good news for us because the utilization rate of aircraft would suddenly shoot up because we can fly a lot longer. That's the side on my side. We've had the South African Power Project, which, Chair, I think we would be more than happy as well to come and make a presentation to the committee. The South African Power Project picks up on some of these issues that you raised because this presentation was just dealing with the current crisis around the whole build program of ESCOM from now for the next 20 years. Not just only ESCOM, but it's the whole electricity system. It does include nuclear. It raises the question of when you go into nuclear, what is the capacity that you need to invest in, both in the form of skills for nuclear manufacturing, the R&D, the technical project management skills that you'd require. But also the other element that we've been focusing on is that if you have a big build program by state-owned enterprises, which is over a long-term period, how can we leverage that to have additional manufacturing directly happening in South Africa? So we've done quite a lot of work around that, and that is something that we can present, and that does cover then a lot of the questions around what investments would then need to happen, where we'd need to build additional capacity in nuclear regulator and all of the other regulatory bodies as well. I'm more than happy to come and make a presentation to yourselves around that. It brings me to this point of smelting. We hear this, but we have not received a proposal from any Fed smelter to shut down. We are not aware of how much that would cost us, and so we are not in a position, both as Department of Public Enterprises and even ESCOM, to be able to really comment. As soon as we receive that, we'll evaluate it on the back of its merits, the amount of megawatts it brings in, the number of jobs that you undertake, because there must obviously be some jobs, even if it's a smelter. But the one concern that we've had, and I think we continue to raise, is that as an economy which is dependent on mining as a sector, invariably, when mining is value-adding, you've got to smelt something, and it requires additional electricity. When you start saying you're shutting down smelters, I think we should think really long and hard about the effect that it would have on value addition in the mining sector, first of all. This portfolio committee via the Department of Mineral Energy Affairs is responsible for the beneficiation strategy. You then have an effect on that beneficiation strategy, and as government departments, I think, we would need clear guidance on whether we're walking away from beneficiation of minerals. Thirdly, you can't be in a manufacturing economy and not have processing, because that processing is the basic input that goes towards making the pot, that goes towards making the fork on the other side. So I do think a lot more discussion and has to happen before we come at the final position. Now, fair comment. The DEP, the developmental pricing on electricity, notionally exists, but there's no electricity to be able to sell at that reduced price. And in fact, the reduced price is not actually a truth, as is often reflected. The price at which large smelters get is the true cost to their company of delivering their electricity. Holding abeyance, whether the whole system, because that's the question, does everyone who consume electricity in South Africa pay the true cost of the production? Because of Eskom's low base, it's a different number. When you bring in IPPs who have to borrow money and the rest and like, those numbers start to change. What we did in the case of the I imagine the investments in the back of the member's mind, which is not mentioned, is the fact the only difference that was introduced is that because we did need to strengthen the system getting into the Eastern Cape in any case, and so the externalities of strengthening that route were into the whole system, you could then take away that direct cost. But the DEP, by and large, is from forward price, is forward curve, pricing curve. It isn't in any way a much greater reduction on price than would exist for other key customers that Eskom would have on the system. However, all major projects of that nature have been held. We don't have additional electricity that's available necessarily for more projects on that on a DEP type price.
If I can just deal with the honourable member's question around Soweto, not feasible. Even the one in Cape Town is not feasible to bring back. It's just going to take too long. It's a big job. We started Camden. We look after these quite well. We spent millions of rands in actually looking after them while they mothballed, and it took us 6 to 7 years to bring them back. We just don't have the time. It's very, very difficult to start bringing the Soweto power station back, or for that matter, even the one that you have standing in Cape Town. I will not recommend that. Going forward around waste generation, a lot of work needs to happen, and we would support that going on. But for renewable focus for South Africa, if we want the country to move forward, I think the issue around solar water is a big issue. We can deal with that. We can get a big contribution. South Africa's got a lot of sun. We all know that. That's where our focus should be. Wind is a mature renewable technology. We don't have a lot of wind in South Africa. Maybe contrary to the people saying Cape Town, but we are a wind-moderate country. We will be investing in a wind farm on the west coast of South Africa, and that should be the country's two main focus areas. In terms of the planning of Eskom, I think we've dealt with that. Why were these shut down? Because of the planning, they were not needed. we had way excess capacity. They were very expensive, and at the time, the country just could not afford running them. And that's why they were shut down. Obviously, in 2003, we started the refurbishment. We should have started that again a long time sooner, but we could not do that. You've mentioned the issue around nuclear. Our focus in terms of our expansion plan going forward is conventional nuclear plants. In terms of the next generation, that's what we need, big baseload plants, and to that extent, certainly, we have a public consultation process going in terms of environmental impact assessment. We're busy with feasibility studies. We've not made a final decision on the construction of the first nuclear plant in South Africa. Hopefully, during this year, we'll do so at Eskom and then put that to our shareholder for their approval or not. The issue around coal, I think I have dealt with it. We cannot use all the export coal. I think it's very important that we have a market that coal miners have got certainty in terms of their markets, and we don't distort the industry. We have enough resources in the country, and we just have to make sure the allocation of those are done correctly so that we don't put the African security of supply at risk. And I must say that coal is the biggest risk in terms of the country's security of supply if we don't have it fixed. Mozambique and Botswana, I think I've dealt with Botswana and the project there. We're currently importing from Cabarabasa, and we're upgrading our import station at Ampolo to get more power. They need to do it on their side. We're working with them on other projects in Mozambique, hydro projects, as well as coal, as well as possibly gas projects, which can alleviate the situation.
The Honourable Member raised the issue of CSLs. They agree that the price is is quite high. What we do know is that there is possibly a Philips investment in a factory to manufacture the CSLs that's going to be located in Lesotho. So that would mean that there's additional supply available in our part of the world. Secondly, the fact is this electricity crisis meets us at the same time that China is. So the Chinese are importing a huge whack of CFL, so they aren't really that easily available in the market at this particular juncture, but I think we're doing everything that we can to make sure that the price goes down. We're mindful of one thing, that over the long term, they are much more efficient than incandescent. They last much longer than incandescent light bulbs and the rest of the night. But because as an intervention, CFLs are particularly important for low-income households because they generally would use lighting and some water heating. And in fact, the geyser penetration rate in low-income housing is very low. It is a concern because to buy four CFLs for a household is closer to 100 rand, despite the fact that they last you for 3 years. However, it's for that reason that between the DME and Eskom and the National Energy Efficiency Agency, we are running a program for 15 years to do a free replacement program for incandescent for CFLs in low-income households. It's in recognition of that fundamental point. The bylaws, we would imagine, I mean, would have to cover small things like during the middle of the day, municipal lighting should be off. Those kinds, and also introducing much more efficient lighting, LED kind of lights, CFL type lights also for municipal lighting on streets as well. So we wouldn't want, we've been quite clear that in essential services and for reasons of safety, you don't want to compromise any of those interventions. A question that I should just answer despite members not asking is in the load shedding schedule, obviously when you load shed a municipality, what has Department of Transport had approached us to see whether you could not load shed the traffic lights. And we were asked also, could we save the essential services as well? And it's unfortunate that many of these systems are embedded into the distribution network of the municipality. So you can't separate out the traffic lights, neither can you separate out hospitals nor prisons. But the law requires that at least hospitals and prisons must have backup generators. We've agreed with the DPLG that with Eskom distribution as well as EDI, we'd assist in looking at backup generators in all of the hospitals to ensure that those are in good order and are maintained appropriately so that they are available to support the system as and when is necessary.
Metro. Okay. Thank you very much. I think this interaction has been very helpful for the committee. I don't think we can go any further now. I think you have tried to respond to all the concerns of the members, except to say that there are a number of, the suggestions or the proposal that you have made that we have, to come and make some presentation on very issues that you have mentioned. Actually, they seem to be more than worth the time of the committee sessions, which are usually about 2 hours. Probably we must think about having a workshop together, because I've got a number of issues also which we can share interest with. You know, I am I am one of the energy people, so there's a lot of things that you have mentioned. For instance, I would have liked us to discuss the question of, when it comes to nuclear, the possibilities of the conventional nuclear power plants versus the small modular reactor. You know, which possibility, or they also what they call medium modular reactors. So, and check which one probably would be more advantageous for our situation. For instance, also the question of deregulation and energy reforms or public utility reform, what impact they have in society, in accessibility of poor communities to electricity, things like that. The Californian experience, Brazilian experience, in terms of these power shortages, outages and so forth. So there are so many things that we have, we can discuss together. The question of distributed energies, how we can be utilized also to upgrade the base load and so forth. And so there are so many things that we can discuss together. I think a workshop would be very worthwhile, which would involve you and probably the people of Minerals and Energy of DME. And I think that would be, we must think along those lines in terms of coming with all types of solutions that can solve the problem. Because they say, once you are, unity is strength. They said that if you are united, then you are stronger than when you work alone. I think that is what we must aim for. But I'm very thankful for the brainstorming response that you have contributed to the committee. At least we are better than yesterday, today, you see. Yeah, we are very, very better than yesterday. And I don't know why you didn't come earlier, because we have been facing these questions in our constituencies. We didn't know what to say. Actually, I've been, myself, I've ran away myself from media, because each time they want to talk to me, I say, I don't know what to say. I have to meet with these people first before I can talk to you. No, thank you very much. We can allow.